Hi there! My name's David Brook, and this is AIPT Comics Podcast, the number one comics podcast for AIPTComics.com. I am your co-host, David Brook, and with me is Forrest Hollingsworth, who's the coolest cat in all the land.
Hello! That's Forrest with two R's, and although David introduced me as Forrest Hollingsworth, my last name is also Forrest.
Oh my god, I totally ruined your gimmick.
Yeah.
Of the week.
This is the first time you've anticipated it. I was like, fuck.
That's why I had no idea, dude. So I'm so sorry. We can redo it, but
no,
we won't.
No, it's okay. It's silent. You know how it's like silent.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Totally.
And invisible. And how my last name's actually Hollingsworth.
Uh-huh. Of course. Always. So this is our very special show where we're going to have Jordan White, the Marvel Comics X-Men editor extraordinaire, on the show to answer our questions. This is the man behind X-Men Monday who works with Chris, who curates the X-Men Mondays column every Monday for the last, what is it now? What are we on, 13, 14 X-Men Mondays? And it's one of the coolest columns, and actually we're going to be talking about it in our news portion because just a few days ago, on Monday of this week, Jonathan Hickman answered your questions, your fan questions, and that's exciting. And he actually had a couple doozies in there. That kind of give you a hint at what is to come with his two series, Hoxes and Poxes.
Hoxes, Poxes.
Actually, it's not plural, but anyway.
No, House of X and Powers of Ten.
Yes, Powers of Ten. So this is the comics news and review show where we talk about our favorite comics and what's going on in the industry, as well as doing some fun segments, which we're actually going to do. We're going to do a fun segment with Jordan White this week, which is going to be pretty cool.
We are. I'm pretty excited. Yeah,
me too. We haven't done a segment with a guest yet, so that's going to be new.
So we're going to put him on the spot. And if it blows up, it's your fault, dear listener.
How do you spell potato? Go. So in the news this week, some bigger news, actually it's probably some of the biggest news that's come out in a while because it's so shocking, is that Tom King is exiting Batman with issue number 85, which is crazy because he was supposed to go all the way up to 100, I think?
I think it was supposed to be 105.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
kind of a weird number anyway, but yes.
That's true. I mean, he's been talking for a while that he's going to be ending his Catwoman arc or his grand scheme over those issues. And, you know, immediately I assumed, oh gosh, he was being fired because he, you know, exposed himself or something. But that's not the case. That's not the case at all, is it? You know, some tweeting went around earlier today. Mm-hmm. CBR reported that they reached out to him. Tom King himself tweeted out, "So many kind notes, you all rock." Which seemed a bit solemn, to be honest, but...
Yeah, I mean, it at least seemed like a confirmation of something.
That's true.
Bleeding Cool originally reported that he was leaving. They didn't really assign a reason to it, and then King tweeted that.
They also didn't have any legit sources. They said they had good sources, but they didn't say who.
Right, and then King kind of came out, and that's about as much as a confirmation as I need, to be honest.
For sure. And Mitch Gerads came out and did a little gif saying jumping to conclusions. So clearly, I think people thinking that he was fired is probably off base.
Absolutely. And given the fact that IGN, CBR, comicbook.com, a couple of other places have reported that they've also talked to DC sources at this point, potentially or presumably the same folks that Bleeding Cool have talked to, saying that King is remaining under his DC exclusive contract and that he already has other stories lined up. I'm assuming with Mitch Gerads, because Mitch Gerads tweeted one thing that says, "I know things about a thing and it all means even better things," eloquently put, with a Batman gif smiling, and then new project inspiration with Kingdom Come and Alex Ross's Justice and stuff like that. So I think it's pretty obvious that he's just kind of pivoting into another project.
Right. And King is the king of miniseries. Let's be honest.
Right. And it's very possible that, you know, coming out of Heroes in Crisis and stuff, that he just felt that the story to tell there was stronger.
Sure. Sure.
And then maybe editorial agreed. I don't want to say that that means he was fired.
Right.
It just maybe means that they agreed about a certain direction for the character, or maybe for Justice League, or for whatever else, or something really interesting for Year of the Villain.
In our news last week about how, you know, King came out and said that he can't believe what they're letting him do with Batman, that still stands. He could still pull that off by issue 85.
Yes, I believe that this arc is called City of Bane, and it was actually supposed to carry it through, like, the entire end of the series.
Right.
And they said that they're still working on making this arc the biggest thing to ever happen in Batman. So it's not really like the language around it or the intention or anything has changed aside from the number of issues. So
right. It's just, it comes out as a shock because you don't usually see this in comics.
Right, yeah.
And they don't go, oh, Snyder's going to be doing Justice League till this issue. And then they go, oh, wait, actually, no, that's not true.
Right, and it certainly makes me wonder about who they have coming in or if they need to find someone to start writing Batman.
Yes. Who do you have anyone in mind who wants to pick up at 86?
Man, that's it's a weird spot to be in, right?
Yeah, it is, yeah. Well, I mean, King followed up Snyder, so I mean...
That's true.
Who's the next Snyder in King?
I don't know.
Tom Taylor?
I would love that. I would love that, but he seems to have his hands full.
No, then he
full.
Won't be doing Spider-Man
yeah,
anymore.
Right. Yeah.
I vote Fred Van Lent. He does a good job.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
And other news, sales figures came out for April, right? Yeah. And $37.5 million were made in the comic industry in 2019, which is a drop, actually, from a year ago, which was $45.84 million in April 2018. Mm-hmm. Clearly, the comic industry is falling apart.
Oh, it's flatlined. It's dead.
Oh.
Yeah, obviously.
That's still a lot of money, but it is interesting that the number is lower.
Well, and we've talked about this in the past in that the delivery avenues for comics are changing. And I don't think necessarily that retailers have met consumers in all of those avenues or as far down the road as consumers want them to.
Mm-hmm.
And you may continue to see a little bit of attrition before retailers get there, I think.
Right.
There is still all sorts of evidence that points to this being one of the biggest years in the history of comics for sales overall in terms of trades, mm-hmm. maxi series, executive editions, you know, all sorts of hardbacks and stuff like that, that fans want to buy, but the single issue game is where it seems like the publishers are losing a little bit of ground.
At the same time, I mean, the number one comic was War of the Realms number one, an event book, okay? Something that fans all over the internet claim that they are sick of, and yet it's the number one book. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you don't like events, you have to vote with your wallet, folks.
Yeah, I think people are so interested in the jumping on point.
Yeah.
But then tie-ins tend to saturate the event so much that it makes it really difficult. Mm-hmm. You'll see the same thing with the sales figures for Age of X-Man.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Where they were really, really strong, and then they just kind of jumped off of a cliff because of a smattering of tie-ins, a kind of confused main arc. Even though I think that everyone on the X-Men team did a really good job of being like, look, you can read the Alpha issue, you have to read the Omega issue at the end, and you can only follow one miniseries through if you want. I think that they did a really good job around the messaging for that.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that they can't stand to compete against how exhausted people are by the majority of events.
Well, I mean, Marvel released twice as many comics as DC. So, I mean, they're just flooding the market at a certain point. And I mean, let's be honest, there's a certain point where you're going to pick up one or two tie-ins, but maybe not all 10 or whatever, how many there are.
Right.
And that not only makes a reader feel left out, but also can make them feel lost. Like, oh, I don't really know what's going on with Bishop because I'm not reading Prisoner X, but I didn't really care for that book for whatever reason, you know? I mean, it's kind of a confusing kind of realm that Marvel, and in particular, because I think Marvel is the one that really comes in with the hard with the tie-ins.
I think that that's true. Or with the tie-ins that feel essential.
Yeah.
Right. The War of the Realms Uncanny X-Men tie-in feels essential to the Uncanny X-Men run, Rosenberg's Uncanny X-Men that's coming out right now. These line-wide crossovers are dissuading, I think.
Whereas, you know, with DC, the number three book was Batman Who Laughs, which was Batman Who Laughs. Which number was it?
Number four, I believe.
Was it number four?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. And just to your point, Batman Who Laughs is like a basically a mini series, but it's going to be bleeding into Batman Superman by Joshua Williamson. So it's like it's sort of like an ongoing event in a sense, you know. It's just not as huge, and you know, there's a zillion books tying into it.
Right.
And one other thing I wanted to say about sales, Thanos number one, I think it got the Avengers Endgame bump. In other news, X-Men Monday, AIPTComics.com bringing you the news. Literally, we are bringing you news with Jonathan Hickman's interview with fan questions and also Chris Hassan's questions. And three things popped out at me I wanted to talk about really quick. One, he was asked, you've said that Magneto is your favorite X-Men character. What is it about the character that appeals to you most? And he said that that with each passing day, he's more and more ideologically of the times.
Yeah.
That is a thinker.
For it's me, interesting, anyway. Right? Because he didn't say any more than that.
Right. That was
That's
it.
The whole answer.
Yeah.
And Hickman is a pretty verbose and well written and explained guy. A lot of the answers in this article are really well written.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I guess he assumes that people know what that means, or he wants people to think about it going into Hoxes Poxes.
Right.
Which is interesting to me.
It adds a political angle, I would say.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It does. And it makes me maybe even almost a scientific angle.
Sure.
Given the marketing that they did around Hox and Pox. And I'm very excited to see where he goes with that, given that Magneto has featured a lot in the marketing.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, he hasn't been a prevalent character of late. I mean, he is a prevalent character in Age of X-Men, but prior to that, I don't think he's been super in the books, has he? Am I crazy?
He's not. No, he kind of took a step back after Bunn wrote him for a long time. That Magneto series was really fantastic.
And if you're a Magneto's clone, you're dead, okay? Joseph lost his head a couple issues ago. Spoiler alert. In another question, someone asked, who is going to make up your core X-Men team going forward? And he cleverly got around that. He basically said, I don't believe in teams. I don't believe in teams on missions. He kind of basically explained he's taking this in a whole new direction. It's not just a school. It's not a team. It's something else. But what else could there be besides a bunch of heroes standing around together?
Mm-hmm.
What did you take from that answer? I'm putting you on the spot.
That it's going to be more about culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's going to be more about the lifestyle or the necessity to change the lifestyle of the mutants. Mm-hmm. That they often define themselves by their mission or by the structures that they put themselves in. Like, how many of the X-Men still need to be in school?
I know, right?
Right? That's such
no
a
one's
weird,
aging, though, in
That's
comics.
Such a weird conceit.
Right.
Right? And I think that that's kind of what he's calling out.
Mm-hmm.
They're defining themselves by, like, always being on the mission or always being in school. And that's a really weird thing to do, given that they have their own internal culture and communication and abilities and stuff like that that is hardly ever developed outside of the ecosystem or the microcosm that they find themselves in.
Right. I think it's exciting. It shows that he's going to be taking this in a different direction.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or at least he's saying he will. Who knows?
Absolutely. I'm pretty excited for it. I love Laura Kinney, X-23, because she's very particularly driven by her mission.
Yeah.
But I'm also really interested in him writing characters that are not that.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
And then in a bit of a fun answer, he basically said, don't expect Storm to be in one costume across the entire line because she's got a closet filled with costumes we've seen her wear for 40 years or however long X-Men has existed. So, and he's leaving it on the artists or the creative teams on the books that are going to be spilling out of Hox and Pox to decide which costumes they want to use, which I think is really cool. I think it's fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And his answer to that actually made me kind of think about what I was just saying previously, because the big thing he said, as far as I'm concerned, is that mutants wear mutant clothes.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Like all the helmet that Magneto wears, which he posted a picture of on Twitter after the fact.
Right.
All that stuff. You know, and arguably Magneto needs that helmet to control his abilities or whatever.
To stop Xavier from messing with his head.
Yeah, right. There's all sorts of weird stuff. And it's also been retconned and changed 1,000 times over. But the fact is that it is iconographic to them. And also, they have to put that stuff on every day.
Right.
Like, it's not just a uniform.
And especially the ones who, the mutant abilities that aren't necessarily, you know, contained in clothing. I mean, like, if you've got, like, a claw, you're not going to be wearing necessarily regular clothes.
And that, again, that changes everything about their culture.
Right.
And it seems like that's what he's really interested in exploring.
Mutant culture.
Yeah. And I'm excited by that.
In other news, Marvel released their Absolute Carnage schedule, and there's a lot more tie-ins than I expected. we've talked about this before. I thought it was going to be only in August, but it's spilling from August to September into October.
Yes.
And Absolute Carnage is what, a 4-issue series? Am I right about that? I think so.
The mainline series appears to be. It's Absolute Carnage 1 and 2 in August, Absolute Carnage number 3 in September, and Absolute Carnage number 4 in October.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of tie-ins, similar to War of the Realms, that aren't like just regular books that are kind of jumping in. They're actually Absolute Carnage titled books, right? Or unless I'm wrong, but Absolute Carnage Miles Morales number 1 is not the continuation of Miles Morales' current story.
It is a mini-series written by Saladin Ahmed.
Right.
For Absolute Carnage, but starring Miles Morales.
So they're totally using the same like format as War of the Realms, which is that they have these tie-ins that are actually miniseries.
That are actually miniseries, yes. But rather than a line-wide or every Marvel book effect, it seems much more tailored here. Yeah. It's like Absolute Carnage, Miles Morales, Separation Anxiety, which I'm super excited about, bringing back the Life Foundation symbiotes. Mm-hmm. Deadpool, you've got Symbiote Spider-Man, another Deadpool issue, Ghost Rider, Immortal Hulk is in there.
That's a good one. I can't for that because like that's a horror.
It seems like they're very intentional with what they're doing.
And the only books that are the mainline books that are being affected is Venom, which is 3 issues, and two issues of Amazing Spider-Man.
Right. And it's arguable whether or not Venom is being quote-unquote affected, right? Because this feels like what it's been building to.
Mm-hmm.
It feels deserved. It feels worthwhile. And I think that War of the Realms feels that way for Thor.
Sure.
But I don't know that War of the Realms feels that way for the entire Marvel universe.
Mm-hmm.
I absolutely think that Absolute Carnage makes sense in terms of affecting Miles Morales or in terms of affecting any other character that's worn a symbiote. I'm really looking forward to it. I really enjoyed reading Spider-Geddon, the mainline series, and all of the tie-ins, just because that was like all I had to do for weeks at a time was deep dive into the Spider-Verse, which is what my favorite thing to do. It's the reason I got into comics.
You went all in, buddy.
I did go all in, and I will probably go all in again with this. The fact that they're bringing back characters like Scream and Riot and Phage stuff, characters that haven't been around since Lethal Protector.
Marvel Legends needs to get their act in order and
produce
some more symbiotes for us.
Yeah, yeah. It's crazy how tailored to me it seems.
Yeah.
But I also cannot believe how good it is. Like, authentically good.
Surprisingly, Marvel's next, I wouldn't call it a reboot, but they're starting with number one again with Ghost Spider.
Yes.
In August. And it's the same timing, but I guess she's not going to be pulled into this whole Geddon.
She's not. No.
This is going to be written by Sean McGuire with art by Takeshi Mamiwazawa.
Yes.
And it's about her living in Earth 65, but coming over to 616 and palling around with Peter and Miles.
Mm-hmm. I think, so basically what's happening for anyone that's slightly confused by it, after Spider-Geddon, Spider-Gwen's book was titled Spider-Gwen Ghost Spider.
Right.
But her name had effectively switched to Ghost Spider. They had switched everything. They had switched what she was calling herself, although she kind of flip-flops on it a little bit, to Ghost Spider. They're relaunching it now, dropping the Spider-Gwen moniker. She's just going by Ghost Spider. The whole line is just going by Ghost Spider, which makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
That's like me going up to someone and saying, "Hi, I'm Forrest Hollingsworth, superhero."
Uh-huh.
Right? Don't find out who I am.
Right.
I know she revealed her identity in a previous story, but it's confusing. It's weird. It's a poor choice. Ghost Spider makes a lot of sense in terms of the story that Shonen's telling. Mm-hmm. It also makes sense in terms of just like basic heroic standards, practices.
Right. It makes sense.
So the relaunch makes sense. I think the marketing is a little unfortunate.
What's wrong?
It's like 11 issues in. And so it seems, I think from the outside, if you haven't been reading every issue and you didn't start in Spider-Geddon, which again is a tie-in event, mm-hmm. tie-in heavy event, and then start reading Ghost Spider, and then you see this, you're kind of like, man, they really can't figure that out, huh?
Oh, yeah. I see what you're saying. Yep.
But they can. I think that this has probably been the plan for the whole time. And for someone that's along for the ride, like me, it makes a lot of sense. But externally, it looks bad.
Yeah, I mean, I almost think like, oh, is there like a copyright infringement on Spider-Gwen that they can't use internationally or something?
Mm-hmm.
So they changed the name so you can use it.
Right, right.
I'm going to totally check this out. I didn't give the Spider-Gwen Ghost Spider series a chance. Just didn't have time, but I think this is a good time to jump on.
I thought it was really good. I think it's really well done.
And they are definitely rebooting again. They're using their number ones to sell books.
Yep.
Just keep it going, man. Don't. It's a ticker. It doesn't go backwards.
People crave the circular door.
I don't think anyone thinks the number one is going to be worth something someday anymore. Like, that's gone.
No. No.
But you know what's here? It's our next segment, Top Books of Last Week, where we talk about our favorite book that came out last week. And I'm going to go first. You cool with that?
Absolutely.
It's a War of the Realms tie-in. War of the Realms Strike Force, The Land of Giants, written by Tom Taylor with art by Jorge Molina. And I loved this issue because Taylor knows how to write a fantastic Spider-Man. It's very funny. There's multiple parts that are hilarious. This is taking place, actually, I think almost two issues ago in the main book. In the very first issue of War of the Realms, Spider-Man, Captain America, Luke Cage, Iron Fist, they all go off on this adventure to find Thor. And they go fight some ice giants. Actually, that might be issue two. Anyway. Or did they find Thor at the end of issue one? Doesn't matter. It's already happened. So the entirety of this issue isn't very necessary in the grand scheme of things. And maybe that's a bit of a spoiler because there isn't like some big revelation or someone doesn't get like an item or a MacGuffin to carry forward. That said, it's a highly entertaining adventure. I called it in my review at aptcomics.com delightful. Spider-Man is perfectly written. He cares about his team. He doesn't kill, even though his teammates are. By the way, Wolverine's on the team too. He stabs an ice giant so many times in the face, and he talks about like brain spilling out. It's crazy.
A murderer?
Yeah, basically. Iron Fist like punches one of the ice giants in the face so hard its head explodes. Meanwhile, Spider-Man's got his shield and his helmet. The things you were talking about, how much you loved.
Yeah, I love when they play around with that character design.
We find out how he got the helmet, so you'll like that. I'm going to stop spoiling it, but it's drawn. It's super clean, the drawing. The pencils are amazing. Inks are amazing. Color's amazing. Like, even, like, there's detail in the black of his eyes on the mask. I'm speaking of Spider-Man, where it's, like, it comes out a little bit. Like, that little fine detail of the costume. It just adds a realism that's so cool. And there's even some deeply emotional moments in the book I'm not going to spoil. So totally pick this up. Even if you've read all of War of the Realms or you don't care about War of the Realms, both read this because it's great Spidey storytelling.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm going to check it out.
For obviously. Sure. I mean, yeah. You're Spider-Man. Spider-Man head.
Yeah. Webhead.
Webheads. What am I? What am I, a noob? What was your favorite book of last week?
What is all this 1990s slang?
What, noob? That's not... Yeah. That's not...
Oh, yeah, that's... No. I mean... Arguably, that's like two decades old now.
Oh, wow. I am so old.
Yeah, man.
What's your favorite book of last week?
My favorite book of last week was Steve Orlando and Riley Rossmo's Martian Manhunter number 5. I reviewed it for the site. I gave it a 10 out of 10. I'm just going to read what I wrote in the final letter review box for Martian Manhunter.
Cool.
I wrote, "Truly, Martian Manhunter is unlike any other book on stands today. It's emotionally rich and resonant, morally complex and revelatory. And still bombastic and comically fun in a traditional sci-fi sense that rings true with no near to no missteps to be seen. With the release of every issue, I'm both saddened by knowing that it will end with the 12th and wanting it to last forever, and immediately eager for the next month's release." It's a singularly fantastic, impacting story about identity and alienation. And for the past 4 issues, it has been largely explored through the eyes of Martian Manhunter, Zon Zones, John Jones, whatever you want to call him. But this issue kind of blows the whole story wide open and takes a look at the same issues through the eyes of the central villain, Charn, through the supporting cast, through John Jones's partner, Diane Mead, the detective. It starts exploring all of these other moral ambiguities and character traits and this depth of grayness and trauma and happiness as well that I found really, really fascinating. It certainly doesn't try to present Charn, the main villain, as a good guy. I don't think that he is a good guy at all. He's essentially committed genocide against the Martians of Mars.
Mm-hmm.
But it shows that John Jones, he doesn't recognize who he is, even though the book opens with this council of manhunters burning Charn so that his skin turns red, not the normal Martian green.
Mm-hmm.
For some unseen crime, right? And that presumably this council has done that to thousands of other Martians, right?
Right.
That they're kind of indiscriminate in their punishment. And does the punishment fit the crime? Probably not. I think that that's really, really fascinating. I think that it's really interesting to put a very young Martian manhunter up against someone like that, born out of his own home.
Mm-hmm.
And born out of the same legal systems, but on the other side of it. It's really well done. It's a very interesting story about identity. And it still has a long way to go. There's going to be 12 issues. But I just am really surprised by the depth of character development and also plot development they've been able to do in only 5 issues.
Nice.
To say nothing of how fucking awesome Riley Rossmo's art is. There's a scene in this issue where Charn is telekinetically tormenting John Jones.
Mm-hmm.
And Jones is imagining that his skin is like bubbling away.
Ew.
And then they keep cutting back to Charn looking at him and showing that it's not actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
But then cutting back to Jones, who is imagining it. It's really, really well done. It's really cool. It's very expressionistic, both. Very detailed, very flowy and weird. I like it a lot.
Nice. Yeah, I like the first issue, but I haven't had time to keep reading it. But the creative team is amazing.
Yes.
I'm glad you're liking it, bro. What'd you give
it? I'm very excited by it.
What did you give it in your review?
I gave it a 10 out of 10. What? I didn't even list any negatives on that son of a gun.
Holy dang. That's a lot.
10.
That's the end of our favorite comics of last week's segment. Next up, top books
for next
week.
That's all my fingers.
That's true. What is there any comics coming out May 29th that you're like looking forward to?
I'm pretty excited about. All right. Well, let me tell you about this one. I'm pretty excited about a book called The Grand Abyss Hotel. Mm. It's written by Marcos Pryor with art by David Rubin.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know very much about it. I'm actually going pretty much solely off of the creative team here.
Who publishes it?
It is a Boom book, I believe. And it's coming out in a full trade.
Ooh.
So it's just going to be a completed story like they did with David Rubin's Beowulf previously.
Oh, yeah.
I'm really excited by it. It's supposed to be a highly satirical, hyper-violent take on politics today.
Nice.
It doesn't seem like there's much more detail besides that. It's just got a guy running through an explosion in a ski mask on the cover.
Huh.
But Rubin's Beowulf was amazing.
It's not directed by Wes Anderson, is it?
I don't think so.
It's a Grand Budapest Hotel joke for you guys.
I got it.
I'm so funny.
Even just seeing Rubin's art on the cover of this book coming out, The Grand Abyss Hotel,
mm-hmm.
It was immediately kind of synaptically snapped back to specific imagery and moments in that Beowulf story.
Cue Eminem.
And also,
snap back to reality. Sorry.
Other moments in a book that he did with Kurt Pyers as well.
Oh, yeah.
So just the fact that there are like whole pages or spreads that I can remember from books he did like 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Says something about the visual acuity and the language that he's developed.
If you look at the first letters of each word,
mm-hmm.
Ga. I think I think I just spoiled something. Someone gets stabbed in this book. Calling it.
Oh.
See that? That's called detective work.
Huh.
My most anticipated comic out next week is Batman Last Night on Earth number 1 by Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo. This is the DC Black Label book that they've been talking about for quite a while. Three issues, 60 pages per issue. So you're basically getting like a mini graphic novel next week. And, you know, Scott talked about it a little bit on the podcast when he was on a few, what is it, months ago now? Jeez Louise. Yeah.
Spend a minute.
The book is, it's almost like a Twilight Zone episode of Batman. It starts with Bruce Wayne waking up in Arkham Asylum. He's young. He's not crazy. And he was never Batman. Dun, dun, dun. I know. And then Scooby-Doo shows up.
Oh, man, I should have recorded that for the soundboard.
This is supposedly Snyder and Capullo's last laugh on Batman. So I think a lot of people are going to be lining up for this one. I'm excited for the format, not only because it's DC Black Label, even though we know there won't be any nudity. DC's against that now.
Yeah.
But it will be darker.
You can't show the dang wang.
Yes, but it will be bloody, I'm sure. And it'll probably be a little bit more violent than what they've usually done, although Joker cutting his own face off is pretty bad.
Well, those things are more allowed than nudity.
I'm always excited for when comic creators who typically do the 20-page issue format do something a little different like this. So I'm very interested to see how the book is paced out and what they can fill in 60 pages. They can get a lot more creative with how the story plays out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's like cool. Almost stupid that I'm saying you should go buy this because I think everyone's going to be buying it anyway.
I'm pretty comfortable saying that it will be number one.
Yeah.
When we review the sales for May.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So speaking of number one, judging by the cover, Junior's our next segment. What is your number one cover art that you loved coming out next week?
The number one cover art that I picked for next week is Dark Visions.
Dark Vader's Vader Visions. Oh my god, I would read that.
It's Star Wars Vader Dark Visions number 4. The cover art is by Greg Smallwood. It depicts a kind of towering, singularly monolithic Darth Vader standing in front of what seems to be a star or sun, and he's holding an X-Wing in his hand, or it's slightly above his hand, actually. It's emitting this nice, subtle red and purple glow against his chest, and then you've got the blue light of the sun kind of on his back. It's just a really, really fantastic, simple but effective image of Vader, and also evocative of the fact that he's a master tactician. Mm-hmm. I think that it really reduces the X-Wing, the hero's vehicle, to looking like a chess piece almost, or like they're in his clutches, in his grasp. And I know that this issue written by Dennis Hopeless Hallam is supposed to be about what it's like to be in an X-Wing fighting against Vader, who's piloting a TIE fighter, saying that Vader is, you know, one of the best TIE fighter pilots in the universe, if not the best. And I think that this cover just really sells that.
I hope at one point he goes, "Now we're pod racing." This series has been really good.
The cover is certainly great.
My favorite cover is The Magnificent Miss Marvel number 3 by Edward Petrovich. And I really love the framing he's done here. There are these tube-like, I would call them tentacles, that are kind of going down the right side and down the bottom. If you go to aiptcomics.com and go to this podcast post, you can actually look at these covers. Anyway, the framing done with these tentacles is very alien. And if you've been reading the series, you'd know that there are aliens involved in Miss Marvel's life right now. So it suits this cover. What?
You made it sound like she's dating.
I don't know. Could be. You never know.
True.
Hey, don't knock alien love. There's an interesting metallic board behind her too that's like a bit rectangular, but then there's a circle within it. It's very cool framing. It almost is like, I don't want to compare it to Jesus, but if you look at those old school medieval paintings, y'all, you'll see that like there's usually a halo around Jesus's head. Sometimes creatively done, so it's not just light, it's something cool. And that this imbues that. It's not around her head, but it's behind her. So it imbues a sense of, I don't know, greatness. And I love the detailing in the costume, the ruffles in her shirt, and then obviously her dress with the blue and the lightning bolt. It kind of flowing really nicely. She looks awesome. Her hair's flowing awesome. She's freaking badass. And when are we going to get a Miss Marvel movie? Kevin Feige.
It's a really fantastic kind of Alphonse Mucha Art Nouveau cover that I like a lot.
Damn it, you just summed up what I said, but cooler.
It's cool. It's it also has got like a little bit of a tarot card thing going on.
Oh, you're so right there, buddy.
Yeah, it's very cool.
So, did you hear that? I think someone's... Yeah, Jordan White's going to be on the show now. So here we are at the segment you've all been waiting for. Jordan White is with us here to answer our questions. This is a pre-X-Men Monday, almost an X-Men Sunday segment. And I'm going to just kick it off with Chris. You've been a master at this this column that's been going on for how many weeks now?
I think this is our 14th week coming up, or 13th.
Very cool, very cool.
I should have got that fact straight. But
and Jordan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having us.
We're all here together. Big hug.
Yay. Here we go. All right, so first question, and it is 13 weeks, apparently. So in the 13 weeks I've been doing X-Men Monday, Jordan, I've learned a lot about X-Fandom, and it's very, very strong opinions. Yeah. So is there anything you've learned these past few weeks you never knew about X-Fans?
Oh, geez. These past few weeks? I mean, realistically, no. That's why I decided that you should start going through all the questions for me.
Well, I've learned a lot.
No, yeah, X-Men fans are passionate is the best way to describe them, because it's value neutral. And that's good, because again, they're passionate because they love the characters so much. And I think I might be wrong. I think they're more passionate than your average Marvel fan. You know, I know Spider-Man fans are very passionate about Spider-Man, but I don't know, it feels different to me than the way X-Men fans feel, and Avengers fans, or Fantastic Four fans, you know? And I think part of that has to do with how much X-Men fans invest in the way that their identity connects to the X-Men. Through the metaphor of the mutant metaphor, or through the actual characters themselves, people feel very closely aligned with them. And so they can get very, very personally fixated on how much a character is used, but also how a character is treated. Like, I've definitely been accused of being disrespectful to a character by having things happen to them. And it's like, well,
that's
like,
hard.
They're not real. So it wasn't like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't feel that it's disrespectful to the person who doesn't exist. I think their job is to go through hard times for us in many ways. Right. But
is that our first interview scoop, that the X-Men are not real?
Wow. What a scoop.
At the perspective from Earth 1218 is that they're not real. Okay. It might be in another reality people think they are, or learn that they are.
And that means they can change, right? I mean, just because the story element happens doesn't mean that they won't change back or change for the better later.
Yeah, a lot of people... so, like, one of the big differences between Marvel and DC is that DC, as you are well aware, has kind of rebooted their multiverse a number of times. Mm. Although oddly enough, like, they've rebooted the multiverse a number of times and then kind of after a while gone, oh, but like, that was just a story that it rebooted, and it's still the same multiverse, but like, anyway.
Right, it gets confusing.
But you know, their continuity reboots and resets, and they go, okay, that didn't... Oh, forget all that, here's more stuff. And Marvel never does that. Marvel is much more interested in just going, let's not talk about the parts that stink.
right.
Yeah.
It all happened, but again, like the example I always like to go to, it all happened, but we don't have to talk about the time that Human Torch stole the Thing's girlfriend and married her, and then she turned out to be a Skrull. We don't have to talk about that. Eventually, a writer will want to, and they'll bring it back up, and hopefully they'll tell a good story with it. But until then, let's just not talk about that.
As editors, does it ever feel like there's a lot of pressure to know every single thing that's ever happened to the X-Men?
Well, I mean, from fans' point of view, yes. In reality, that's not possible.
Sure.
And I listen, I'm making people furious by saying that. There's somebody is
calm
screaming.
Down, everyone.
They really are. And they're going to quote this section of the podcast and go on the message board and talk about how terrible I am. But no, but it's not possible. You know, that's why we have multiple people working on books, and hopefully our combined knowledge knows more stuff. But also, here's the thing. In the great arc of history.
Oh my God.
That's too much.
Story time.
in the final estimation about a story, continuity is less important than the actual story being told, which is not to say, obviously, that if we were like, okay, well, we want to tell a story about Storm and Kitty, but the story we want to tell is about them meeting for the first time, and even though they've met, we don't care, we want to tell a story about them meeting, so we're just going to have them meet right now for the first time. That doesn't make any sense. Stories ideally should make sense and have some sort of consistency to them. But I think that like the minutia continuity is less important than trying to tell a story that has emotional resonance. When people complain about the continuity errors, if they're big ones, 100%, that's embarrassing. I'm embarrassed, and I'm sorry that it happened. But smaller ones, a lot of the time, it just they're not as important as telling a good story is. They just aren't. And one of the examples people will give is like, they're like, oh, well, Doctor Who. And I was like, well, that's a terrible example because Doctor Who is like super inconsistent as far as continuity. Right. Like, right. If you watch all, what is it, 60 years? No, is up to 60? I can't remember if they're at 50 or 50 something, I think, of Doctor Who. It's not going to read like one story because none of them knew it was one story. And you know what? The same is true with X-Men. Obviously, Chris Claremont was able to do it a little bit better because he was one writer controlling a thing for 20 years.
Right.
But even Chris Claremont didn't know how long it was going to be going or when it was going to stop and did not know to plan for it. Comic books weren't set out to be, this is an eternal story. Let's start here and it'll go forever. That's a thing that developed over many, many years. I just don't think it's possible to know all of the X-Men stuff unless you do the Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men podcast. They seem to know all the X-Men stuff, but other than them, I don't know that it's possible.
Backwards and forwards. Sure. How do you keep track of everything as it's coming down the pike? Like, do you have any way of charting what's going on in continuity with all the books now and maybe in the next 6 months?
No, I'm not big on charts. I mean, Jonathan is the chart
person. I was going to say,
charts exist of some things, obviously, because of Jonathan. But no, I'm not like a big chart person. I mean, I make like a document with like deadlines on it just so I don't forget them. But other than that, I don't do a big, database of the characters and where they're going to appear and things like that. Because, well, first of all, I don't really know how to. And second of all, I just tend to try to keep track of the comics, the characters and the continuity in my head. Again, people are furious that I just said that, but that's just the way I like to operate, to keep track of it in my mind, and the important things are important. That's why you remember them.
And that's why they're important. Right. Yeah. That makes perfect sense to me. Speaking of deadlines, though, Age of X-Men is winding down.
Yeah.
Practically wound down.
It's getting close. It's getting close. What are we? I think as we're recording this, a lot of the issue fours are out. Not quite all.
Yes.
Of them.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I was wondering, of the Age of X-Men pitches that you guys got, or when you were discussing at the creative retreats leading into it, what idea were you the most immediately excited about, and which ones took longer to grow on you?
So you're talking about of the miniseries that we ended up with? Or are you talking about?
Yeah. Yeah. Or just in general, any ideas?
So the one that I was most excited about is probably Extremists, because that's the one where we kind of said, I think we're far enough into it that this is not a spoiler to say this, that's the one where we kind of said, to step back, obviously we're already doing a dystopia type stories, and so obviously things about 1984 were being discussed and things about Brave New World were being discussed, but with Extremists I was like, this is where we can do Fahrenheit 451. It's the Enforcer learning that the thing that they do is wrong. And I think that just is a fun idea. I like all three of those books, but I felt like fewer people do Fahrenheit 451 riffs than do Brave New World riffs or 1984 riffs. So I was like, ooh, that's kind of a fun thing to try. And I've really enjoyed what Leah's been doing with it. She's got a very, very character-centric way of writing, where she just really gets into the characters and makes them feel really real and rich and believable. And she's had definitely moments in that series that I was not expecting to happen, and lines that I was like, oh my God, are we going to say that? And it's like, oh, I guess we are. I guess we're saying that. All right.
I know we've talked about it at the website among the staff, but Leah's script, I think it was issue 2. It's just the feelings of like unrequited love. I think it's like so universal, but it's like so personal to Blob and Betsy, obviously. But like, I think anyone can read that and just like, it really resonates with readers. It's really, really great.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, I really am very happy with that book. It didn't turn out exactly the way I thought it would, in the sense of, you know, the book as it stood in my head when it was like, oh, it's like Fahrenheit 451. I didn't expect the way she was going to approach it, but I do think she got that idea across, and in a really interesting way.
Yeah, absolutely. Were there any ideas that took a little bit longer to grow on you, or any that you felt like, or even just missed opportunities, things that you wish you had done?
I'll tell you what has been what was the most difficult. Because it's the one that starts as a no-brainer of course you're going to do that, but then when we actually started it, we went, how does this work? Which is Marvelous X-Men. Because of course we're going to do an X-Men book, and they're the most important superheroes of this world, and they're great. But as we started like really buckling down about it, it was like, but wait, hold on. This world is meant to be perfect. Like, are they fighting crime? What are they? Is there crime? What are they doing? And we ended up with them doing a lot of like disaster relief kind of stuff, which is ended up being, I think, really interesting, but not what you typically see the X-Men doing.
Right.
Because we were like sitting there going, but yeah, like if there's somebody robbing a bank, like that's not the utopia that we were promised, right? Like, I don't know. It was a weird thing to think about, and it was a difficult part to wrestle with.
I mean, for bank robbers, that's utopia, I guess.
That might exist somewhere out there.
Bank robber utopia. So yeah, while we're talking about Age of X-Men, I was curious. So now that we know it's coming next, looking at Uncanny X-Men, Matthew Rosenberg's run, was the entire run something he pitched, or were there certain subplots that needed to be resolved, or characters like Cyclops and Wolverine that kind of needed to be reintroduced ahead of Jonathan Hickman's run?
Well, let me put it this way. We pretty early into my coming into the X-Men office, I knew about the plan to bring Jonathan in. And when I first got there, like it was like, okay, here's the books as they stand, and here's the thing. We're talking to Jonathan. We think we're going to bring him in to do a big X-Men project. And I didn't know what that meant. Like, he hadn't pitched it yet. It was just, he's got ideas. It's going to be something cool and big.
Was this like around October or November?
This was this was, I think, far earlier. I don't remember what month I...
Because Disassembled launched in November.
Yeah, so no. Of that year? Definitely not. We're talking about significantly earlier. This is probably...
Oh, wow. The year 2000.
I cannot remember what month I moved into the X-Men office, but we would have been talking early last year. So I don't know if we're talking about January or February or what, but somewhere in that realm.
Mm-hmm.
And it... So it was like, he's going to be coming in and pitching us a thing, but we don't know exactly the shape of it. We don't know the scope of it. We're not sure what it's going to be. Pretty soon after that, he did come in and he pitched it to us, and it was clear that it is going to be a huge thing. And as he said in his interviews, he pitched the idea of all the X-Men books stop. This is the only book that you're buying that exists. It's the only X-Men book you get for the length of it, and then coming out of it is a whole new world for the X-Men to be in.
A whole new world.
so to speak. Metaphorically. And so at that time, when I came in, it was already, there was already plans to ramp down X-Men Gold and Blue into Extermination. But it was also clear that we were like, well, we can't launch this Jonathan book then. It's not going to work for the timing. We're going to need a lot more runway to get ahead on the art. And it's such a big plan to get ahead on all of it, get ahead on planning. So we figured out that it would be in July of this year, and we went, all right, this is how much time we have now to tell stories. And we had a tentative idea, I think, at that point, that we were going to do something like what ended up being Disassembled, but we didn't know what was going to come after that. And we knew that Wolverine would be back because of Return of Wolverine. We knew that Cyclops would be back because of the plan was to bring him back at the end of Extermination, which again was a plan that existed before I got on the books to bring him back at the end of that. Although I was very happy about it because I remember at the X-Men retreat where they were talking about Extermination, and it was the idea came up in the room of, well, Cyclops should come back at the end, and some people were like no, and other people were like yes, and I was very much like yes, yes he should. Anyway, sorry. So we knew that both Cyclops and Wolverine would be back, but we also knew that because of the timing of Extermination and Death of Wolverine, that they wouldn't be able to be in Disassembled. So kind of again, it's confusing. We were planning all of this at once, you know?
That's a lot.
We were trying to figure out what is this whole period of time. So we talked about Disassembled, and then we were trying to figure out how that was going to end. And when we hit on the idea of it going into Age of X-Men, then the idea came up of, I think I just hit on the idea. I went, well, that means the bulk of the X-Men are gone and Cyclops and Wolverine are the only ones left to come and put back the pieces together. And then we went to Matt and said, do you want to write that story? And by that story, I mean literally what I said. Cyclops and Wolverine come together to put the X-Men back together. There wasn't a, and then this happens, and then this happens. We just had that much. And Matt was like, yeah, absolutely, I'd love to. And he pitched, we said, we got a 6-month period, we can double ship 12 issues. What do you want to do for 12 issues with that? And he pitched what we are doing right now.
It's cool to hear the backstory.
Yeah. That's great.
It's just kind of like, proves your job is a lot more complex than a lot of people probably think of, just, you know, keeping track of a couple books every month. You're tracking a lot of writers, creators, artists over months and months and months. That's crazy.
Yes, and I will say this, this is a more difficult period than most are, because while, you know, Uncanny X-Men is going to be 22 issues before House of X begins, and again, yeah, we did know that they ended up shipping in a quick succession, and so yes, we did end up saying that that's an ongoing series rather than saying it's a 22 issue maxi series, because that would have been weird, and we had our reasons. That would have been weird.
Sure.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I do understand why people are like, oh, well, it wasn't an ongoing. Well, because we knew it was going to end, but it was meant to be the Uncanny X-Men of this period.
I don't know. I mean, 22 issues in the modern comics era is a pretty good run, I think.
Yeah, that's true.
But that said, because it was this very particular job of trying to fit in stories into this period of time, it is very different than the normal job of editing a bunch of ongoing series. It's way more difficult editing a handful of a bunch even of ongoing series that have a regular creative team, even if there are cycling teams of artists because they don't necessarily do a book in a month, is still much easier than trying to coordinate all these different stories that are weaving in and out of each other. I look forward to having a more normal ongoing series again, and I'm happy that that will happen sometime soonish.
TikTok, the calendar's like always your enemy, apparently.
Well, I mean, that's always true, because literally, as soon as I finish anything, the next thing is late. Like I
deadlines.
Mean, it's weekly publishing. You know, we get all the covers done for the catalog, and it's already like, why aren't you working on the next catalog yet? And so that's a good point. I guess we should.
And you got to be so good at keeping secrets, Jordan, because I feel like, I mean, going back for a year, knowing about this Hickman thing, and it's all people want to talk about and speculate about, and even the return of Uncanny X-Men, like, you have to sit on so many secrets constantly. Like, how is that for you?
It's true. It's difficult. Because again, especially when I'm really excited by them, I want to talk about them. The Hickman one, like I said, because it was so long, and here's the thing, it was rumored the whole time. Like, the rumors were echoing around, mm-hmm. and I would do my best to not acknowledge them, or if I had to acknowledge them for some reason, like, do it in a way that, here's the thing, I hate lying. I'm bad at it and I hate it. So there was definitely a time when someone asked me on Twitter about it, and I said something to the effect of, I as the X-Men editor, I feel like I would know if Jonathan was coming on.
Yeah.
Which isn't a lie.
It's true. But it's not a confirmation either.
Whereas Jonathan is very good at lying. So he would just say things like, I don't even know who that is, when someone would ask him about me or something like that. And I was like, oh, that hurts my feelings.
It's been so much fun to watch Jonathan's like interactions with X-Fans on Twitter, because he's not like the usual Twitter user. He's very...
He's a meme lord. He's a meme lord.
Do you know he doesn't... I think he doesn't follow anyone on Twitter.
No. Which is even cooler.
It is cool. It's very cool.
So speaking of Jonathan Hickman, I got to try to get some kind of news here. So is it safe to assume that the Krakoa seeds that are being promoted are tied to all that vegetation we've seen in the promotional images for House of X and Powers of X? Or are these just a snack that the X-Men are eating now, their new the new Hickman diet?
That sounds like a reasonable thing to put together. I mean, you're right. There's a lot of plant life on the covers, and they did show a package of Krakoa seeds.
Have we seen the package yet? I'm not sure if I've seen it.
Did they not show it?
I don't know. Spoilers. They've shown it somewhere. Find it, fans.
It's out there.
I thought they showed it at the retailer thing, but I could be wrong.
Oh, just like a utopia for bank robbers.
It is, yeah.
And you've also said that we can expect the series announcements around this year's San Diego Comic-Con or at the Comic-Con. Mm-hmm. Is it safe to assume that these are going to be entirely new series, or can we expect some fresh starts for familiar titles? Is it going to be a mix?
It's going to be a mix. I think Jonathan said in one of the recent interviews that, some of them will be new takes on classic ideas. Some of them will be completely new ideas. They're all different than any versions of the books that have come out before. That I can definitely say safely. But some of them you can see like, oh, that's like this one, except more like that. Whereas there's at least one that it's like people are not going to see coming, and it's awesome, because it's not at all what you would expect from your typical X book, but it's super fun.
That's exciting.
So are the creative teams identified for the books following House of X and Powers of Ten then?
By me. I know them all. Sure. Yes. They are in process. The books that are going to be launching right after House of X and Powers of X are all being written and drawn right now. They're all being, I think all of them are being drawn right now, but later issues are being written as well. And then we have begun work on a second wave of launches for a number of months later that we're just starting to staff right now with writers.
Since you're part of the process and you see it all being made, you know, what is that saying where you've learned how the sausage is made?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Does it affect how you enjoy the books when they're finished and on the shelf?
Yes and no. I think that honestly it mostly affects it when I know the people involved, because then I'm like thinking about the fact that I know them and that I'm like, oh, did they do this because of, like, you know, because I have an idea of them in my head. Did they do this because this thing happened or because, you know, this other person that we work with said this to them or made them do that? But generally speaking, if I just pick up a comic, I can read it and enjoy it still.
Nice.
Yeah. I just don't have enough time. I used to listen. Before I worked at Marvel, I worked at, well, one of the places I worked was a comic book shop. And even before I worked at the comic book shop, I was buying, and this was, okay, so let me just say, this was over 10 years ago at this point. This would have been like 12, 13 years ago. I was buying $100 of comics a week.
Wow.
Every week. Sometimes that was trades. Sometimes trades would be included in that. But I will say, back then, every one that wasn't a trade, I would read Wednesday night. I have no idea how I was doing it. If I even think about
speed
that.
Speed reading.
The pile of comics that I have waiting to be read right now is so enormous. I can't even fathom how I'm going to get through it. But I don't buy nearly that much now. But that being said, it's mostly because I get the Marvel and DC books I want for free. So right. I only have to buy like Image and Dark Horse and things like that that I want. But I can't even come close to reading them all on a weekly
basis. Your vacations must be just filled with reading comics then.
Well, can I tell you, I always think they will be. I always pack like they will be. I pack like a ton of comics, but then I have a kid now, and you get to a place and it's like, oh, there's stuff to do. And it's like, oh, well, okay, I'll read those at some point. And then I rarely get very far into them.
I know you tweet a lot on the train. Do you often like read on the train, right? And you show kind of the comics you're reading?
Yeah, yeah. Although I used to do it more, and now like, this is a sad truth. Entertainment options, just there's too many of them. Like I've started rewatching Hannibal on the train because I love Hannibal so much, and I own it digitally, so I can download it onto my phone and just watch an episode. And sometimes that feels easier than reading comics.
You mentioned that in the
I totally get that.
Your Hannibal obsession was in the very controversial X-Couples edition of X-Men Monday.
yes, it was. Well, because it's an amazing show. I love it. And so I'm very happy to rewatch it. But that's not the only, you know what I mean? Like, there's just a lot of other things to do. Oh, also, every once in a while, I feel like reading a novel.
What's that? What is a book?
Yeah.
That blows
enrich your mind.
That blows up comics reading so much.
Oh yeah, that's time consuming for sure.
Yeah, I mean, we just have to say our opinions online about them, and that stresses me out sometimes.
But at least that forces you to read them. You have to keep up, right? So yeah. There you go.
True.
When I started at AIPT 7 years ago, I was spending $80 to $90 on comics every week. And yeah, I can relate. Like I was kind of power reading them mostly because I was reviewing, but yeah, it becomes a lot.
It really does. And again, I love it. I love it. When I, like a lot of times recently I will go a long time between reading comics. Like, I'll go, oh, I'm gonna, and then I won't. But then when I actually sit down and do it, I'm like, this is great. Like, why am I not doing this every day? This is so much fun. And then the next day I watch Hannibal.
Well, you know, speaking of Hannibal and X-Couples and all the questions we get, I get a lot of X-Fan Twitter questions every week, and a lot of them are way too spoilery. So with your permission, Jordan, I'd like to do a speed round where I ask you revised versions of these questions that you can actually answer.
Oh!
Are you ready for these questions?
I'm super ready.
Speed round. All right, here we go. So Cyclops and Jean Grey will both be appearing in House of X. Is it safe to assume these two will speak to each other in the pages of an upcoming comic book?
Confirmed.
Perfect. Wow. Twitter is on fire. Once I hear that.
Hot take.
They will talk.
Second speed round question. Cyclops and Emma Frost will be appearing in Uncanny X-Men. Is it safe to assume these two will speak to each other in the pages of an upcoming comic book?
Ooh. Confirmed.
Boy.
Internet just split in half.
Final question. None of the covers for the upcoming Hickman comics feature fan-favorite characters like Psylocke, Rogue, and Gambit. Is it safe to assume these characters will appear in a Marvel comic book in July or beyond?
Or beyond?
Oh, jeez, that's a really tough question.
Oh, no.
No, of course, yeah, of course they will. I can get, they, you know what? I'll tell you what. I guarantee they will appear in a comic at some point between July and December.
There you go.
Right.
Okay. Hey, look, you narrowed it down for us. Right. Not from July to forever.
All right. No further questions, Jordan. You're off the hook.
That's all they wanted to know was those simple things.
Pretty much. It's usually about Cyclops, Jean, or Emma.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw so many people on Twitter screenshot Hickman's response to that Cyclops Wolverine question from this week's X-Men Monday article, and he said Emma. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
The number
Emma
of people,
has a lot of passion.
The number of people stealing our intellectual property by screenshotting it up. And putting it on Twitter.
You know, here's another thing though about the way that people ask questions is that so everybody wants to ask me questions about my opinion, which I'm happy to answer, except they want to read so much into my opinion. Like, if I've said a thing, then that's what I'm going to execute for the rest of my career. And first of all, A, that's not true. I don't just call up every writer and go, okay, here's what I like, so you better do that. In addition, sometimes opinions change. And in addition, like, opinions are complicated. Like, Emma Frost is a great, great character, and I'm glad we got to do that fun whole column focusing on her. It was a blast. But again, I feel like a lot of the response was to simplify everything I said as much as possible. Well, he said he likes her better off the X-Men, so he hates her. And it's like, no, I love her. I love her. I think she's amazing. And she was able to shine most as an X-Man because she got most page time as an X-Man. But I think that her having more time not as an X-Man would be a better situation for her than her having more time as an X-Man.
Interesting.
Because I think she's super interesting and complicated. And also, in addition, like, I do have kind of simplistic views of heroicism, of what makes someone actually heroic versus a protagonist, you know? Mm-hmm. Emma is a terrific protagonist. And has she done things that are good? Of course she has. Has she done things that are very good? Of course she has. I don't know if I'm quite to a place where I would say she is a hero. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think of her as, like, heroic across the board. And generally speaking, I want the X-Men as a group to be heroic. So I don't love Magneto as an X-Man for that same reason. Does that mean I hate Magneto? No. It means that for any good intent he has, I don't think of him as heroic. I think of him as he wants to stop the oppression of his people. That's amazing. That's wonderful. I love that. I think he goes about it in unheroic ways.
Well said.
Thank you.
Well, Jordan, that completes our interview portion of the show. I would like to join you in our segment Super Fight, which is something we've done on the show a couple times now, and it's always a lot of fun. It's where we randomly generate a DC character and then randomly generate a Marvel character and then pulling out a Super Fight card. What is it? Is it Super Fight, Forrest? Yeah.
It is Super Fight. They're not a sponsor, but if they would like to be...
We will determine who is better at whatever it is this card he pulls.
Excellent.
And it's usually ridiculous.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm going to generate the DC character first because we know you love DC.
You know, I have loved DC so much in the past. I don't love it as much as I used to.
That is going Batgirl. To be Batgirl.
Do we know which one?
It looks like the Babs Tarr art.
So Barbara Gordon.
So Batgirl burned. Yep. Yes. Burnside. And the Marvel character is going to be Gambit.
No way. No way. Okay.
Batgirl versus Gambit. Right. And I'm going to draw the Super Fight card here.
I'm so nervous.
That's the deck. Who would be the raddest pro skateboarder?
Oh my God. That's hard.
That is hard. They're both pretty athletic.
I mean, Batgirl does a lot of stuff on that motorcycle of hers.
I'm trying to think if I've ever seen Gambit, like, engaging a vehicle in any way.
He can play basketball. We know that.
I'm going to say I've seen him in a lot of crop tops.
Sure. Like,
I've seen him in a helicopter before. I know that.
But, like, flying it?
No, I don't think so.
Like, did he drive a motorcycle? No, right?
Probably had a motorcycle at least once. Especially in the 90s.
So whoever's better at skateboarding, that's the super fight we got here?
Who would be a better pro skateboarder? I mean, I think those could be different interpretations.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, true.
Yes.
So Gambit's agility is probably much greater than Barbara's.
Do you think so? They both because throw things.
Well, I suppose his powers don't have anything to do with agility.
No. And would they help at all? Like, you don't want to blow up your skateboard.
I know. Well, right. Gambit has those metal boots, though. So if he falls, he's totally, like, way more protected.
No. Again, I disagree. Batgirl is wearing a bat suit. They are super armored just in, like, subtle ways.
Against bullets, but are they against road rash? I'm not so sure.
I'm pretty confident. Again, she rides a motorcycle, so.
That's true.
Gambit can take the jacket off. Point, I've seen him in crop tops. Yeah. Uh-huh. Batgirl always has a cape on.
Right. Oh, the cape. The cape and gets into
no
the
capes.
Both will look cooler while skateboarding. Flowing cape, flowing coat.
Yeah, sure.
Ooh. Oh, man, I'm back
also,
to square
the thing
one.
The thing about Gambit is he can supercharge his board and get like a sick jump.
No, but it would blow it up. yes, Gambit could like do a big, go up the side of the whatever it's called, jump up in the air, blow the board up, but then he just crashes to the ground. He doesn't have a board to land on.
That's true. He could do a sick light show on the X Games with like throwing stuff in the air and exploding things.
Mm, that's true. That's true.
Literally the X Games.
Well, let's think about training though. Batgirl, you know, she's trained with Batman.
The best skateboarder.
Gambit's trained in the danger room. Like, does the danger room have a half pipe in there?
Like it really, it well, it, the danger room has Shi'ar technology. It can simulate anything. So of course he can.
So
make
yes, there's been half pipe in there, confirmed.
This is upsetting to me because you picked an X character. I want them to win. And of course, here's the thing I tell people online. The dirty secret is that any character can beat any character. It just depends on how it's written and who's writing it.
That's true.
I don't think he wins this. I don't think Gambit is going to beat Batgirl. I think she is more, first of all, I think she's more like fun-loving and interested in something as fun and recreational as being a pro skateboarder. It's not recreational. It's a job. But you know what I mean. That it's based on that. I feel like Gambit would be like, that's silly. Like, why am I doing this?
True. Unless he had to skateboard to steal something.
Sure. What would being a pro skateboarder help you steal?
Tony Hawk's
skateboard.
Tony Stark would have been a good skateboarder. He did used to have those roller skates. I think he's
That's
ready.
That's true. All right. Well, you heard it here, folks, that Jordan thinks that Batgirl beats Gambit.
They're going to be so angry. It's all right. We can chalk it up to him being married.
What?
He doesn't want to. He's Rogue is worried about it.
Oh, him
it's
being
fine.
Married. I thought you meant me. I was like, what?
Oh, no. Gambit. Yes.
That's fine.
I just don't see him caring about winning a skateboarding competition.
I agree with that.
Let's cut to a few months. Jonathan Hickman's writing a scene where Gambit wins a skateboard competition.
I hope. That would be my dream. Okay, so Jordan, one last segment for you. It's our off-topic, top-shelf segment. We end every show with this. It's just, you get to talk about, and you're up. Usually we're up, but you're up this time. You get to pick anything that you're really into right now that you want to talk about.
Oh my God. That's not
comic-related.
That's such a tough choice. First of all, I'm not going to say Hannibal because I've already talked about it. You know what? Why don't I talk about my favorite movie? I do that a lot too, but it just is coming to mind, and so why not? My favorite movie is not a movie that I think is a lot of people's favorite movie, and you might be like, "But why is that your favorite movie?" And I won't be able to really answer you because it's a lot of it is just super emotional and weird and just irrational love. But my favorite movie is the remake of Evil Dead.
Oh, wow. Nice. I enjoyed that. I remember seeing that in the theater.
Yeah, I saw it in the theater like 3 times. since then, I've seen it 100 times. I own it on Blu-ray. I came with a digital download, so I literally have it on my phone at all times. If I have a bad day, I will watch it, and it will cheer me up. So if you don't know what Evil Dead is, I will tell you about Evil Dead. First of all, let me say all of the Evil Dead movies and TV show I think are great, and I love them. Evil Dead was a movie Sam Raimi made in, was it 79? It was either 79 or 80, and it was a super indie movie about a group of kids who go out to a cabin in the woods, find an evil book in the basement of the cabin, they play a recording of some passages in the book, and it releases this ancient evil that possesses them and gets them to kill each other. And the first movie stars a bunch of completely unknown actors, but one of them was Bruce Campbell. And spoiler, he's the survivor of the movie and therefore goes on to Evil Dead 2. And I won't get into the weird making of behind weirdness of that, how it remakes the first movie in the first 10 minutes. Just don't worry about it. Evil Dead 2 is so good. But in Evil Dead 2, they kind of leaned a little bit more into the humorous parts of it because they were trying to be really scary in the first one. And then the second one, they went, some people found some of those parts funny and they went, we can push that further. And so it's kind of like walks this line between horror and slapstick comedy almost. And then the third movie was called Army of Darkness, and it gets even sillier, but also in a big adventure-y way. And then there's also the TV show Ash versus the Evil Dead.
Yep. Yes, I do love that. Which was
great. In what I think it was 2012 is when the remake of Evil Dead came out. It's a remake ostensibly of the first movie, but none of the characters are the same. It's just a remake of the premise. A group of kids go to a cabin in the woods. They find the evil book. They read the passage. The deadites, as they call them, or the evil forces come and possess one of them, and eventually more of them, and have them kill each other. What I love about this movie, and one of the reasons it worked so well for me immediately upon seeing it, is that again it took stuff from Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2, which were just kind of wacky fun. Again, they were gory, they were over the top in those movies, but they were leaning towards humor a little bit. And in this movie, they went, this is not humor. We're going to take those same things that made you laugh in that movie and make them horrifying, brutal, and, like, scary. And I think they pulled it off really well. There's stuff in that when I saw it for the first time, I was like, oh my God, what is happening?
The blood rain is just amazing.
The blood rain is crazy.
Yeah.
The bathroom scene in that movie is so gross. I don't know if I'm not going to spoil it for people, but there's the scene that takes place in a bathroom that it has nothing to do with toilet stuff. So that's not why it's gross. It's gross because of gory, like, violent stuff. I couldn't believe I was seeing it the first time I saw it. I was like, oh my God. And now it's like my favorite scene of anything to watch. And again, that's really messed up. And I don't want people to think I'm some sort of psycho killer because I go, I have a bad day. And then I watch all these people murder each other. It's not about that. I don't know. I think the movie's beautiful. The director, Fede Alvarez, he did such a good job of just making a movie that has a tone and a feel. And like every shot, I think, looks gorgeous. From the horrifying ones to the ones that are just like looking at a person in the woods. The tension is really high. All of the performances are great. I've listened to the commentary. They talk about how miserable they were making it because they have to like be out in blood rain for like a week in the middle of the night every night in order to film that long sequence. Things like that. There's only one thing about the movie that I hate.
Uh-oh.
Is that it's one of these things where you ever learn like a real true fact that all media gets wrong, and then when you see that fact, you go, ugh, and you get upset? That's what it is. Here's the thing. My wife's a doctor. You don't shock a flatline. If someone's heart is not beating, you don't electrocute them.
Oh,
that doesn't do it.
I didn't know that.
So the thing that electrocutes you in a hospital, the thing that the paddles and they say clear.
Yeah, the defibrillator.
It's called a defibrillator, correct. And you are supposed to use it when the heart is fibrillating, which means the heart is going blah, 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 like that.
Right.
It is having an irregular pattern, and then you shock it to get it into a stable pattern. When your heart is flatlining, that's not what you do. You do like CPR, you do an adrenaline shot, something like that, but you don't defibrillate them.
Like in Pulp Fiction.
Right, right. So Pulp Fiction is more scientifically accurate than Evil Dead.
Who would have thought?
Oh, there's one other part about the movie that I think I don't hate. I actually kind of love it because it's dumb and wrong, which is there's a part when they talk about one of the characters having had a drug overdose before the movie in the backstory. And one of the characters says, legally, she was dead. And I go, no, legally, she was not dead. They did not execute her will. They did not have her declare dead and sign off all the paperwork. And then she came back. You could say technically she was dead. You could even say medically she was dead, although a doctor would say, no, we didn't say that until we pronounced death. Like, she was not medically dead either. But at least that would be a layman's term. But he says, legally, she was dead. False. Ridiculous. So silly.
That's funny.
But anyway, other than that, I really love it. It's got a lot of horrifying moments, a lot of surprising twists. And yeah, I honestly can't explain why I love it so much or why it makes me so happy. It's just pure love.
Find the answer, X fans. Go watch this movie 16 times.
And you know what? Here's the thing. I actually also will use this when I have a very strong opinion about things that other people disagree with. And I will say, well, you know what? My favorite movie is the Evil Dead remake. So obviously you don't have to trust my taste.
That's funny.
Hopefully people like it if you do watch it. I think it's a beautiful and horrifying movie.
Nice. Yeah, thanks definitely. For sharing.
My pleasure.
Well, you know what my favorite thing is, and something I love, is X-Men Mondays at AIPT. Oh. And so I just want to give a quick plug that so the next edition will be X-Men Monday number 14, which is X-Events. And
X-Events.
X-Events.
I looked at the questions. I haven't answered them yet. Hmm.
That's exciting for the listeners. Something to look forward to. And then the...
Which will be tomorrow when after the show airs.
And then the next week, this is a little bit of a X-Men Monday tease, but X-Men Monday number 15. All I can say is I think there's a big major movie coming out in the first week of June that X-Fans might be interested in. So I'm not going to say what the topic could be. Any ideas, Jordan, for the X-Men Monday 15?
A major movie in June. Nope, we got nothing.
All right. Maybe it'll just be a skip week. It'll be the best of Jordan.
Well, that's the end of our show. Thank you so much for listening up until this moment. And please like, review, subscribe. Thank you so much for being on, Jordan.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Jordan.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, it was great.